Liebe Freunde und Kollegen, ich spreche heute mit José von der Universität Erlangen über Dinge wie, müssen wir eigentlich unsere frisch stilisierten Keramikoberflächen vor Licht schützen? Oder brauchen wir Glycerin-Gel, um unsere frisch adhesiven eingesetzten Talkronen Licht zu härten? Über all diese Sachen spricht er auch bei dem GSEM1-Symposium, das ihr euch online ab dem 27.05. anschauen könnt. Es ist Teil zur Vorbereitung des 100. Geburtstags von GC. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
Welcome to today's show. I'm connected over the internet with José. Welcome to this podcast, José.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And
you're at the university, and actually, I would like to know about the different challenges when it comes to luting, because we have different substrates in our teeth. For example, we have kind of filling material, enamel, dentine, and maybe even some remainments of professional cement.
That's right, yeah.
Let's start with the basic. When you're luting, for example, an onlay or something, what are you doing for cleaning the preparation site?
Well, always when we are luting, or mainly adhesively luting, we need really clean surfaces. That's right. That's the basic principle. Cleaning is when you remove the provisional, you have to remove the remnants of cement and everything which is in this gap or was in this gap. So talking practically, the first step is I take a sickle scaler, and first of all, I try to remove all the big remnants. And afterwards, air abrasion is a good possibility. You have to be careful because you can always damage the margins of your preparation. Yeah. So when you do that, I often use aluminum powder, small, like 35 microns with low pressure. And that's a good possibility to clean. Of course, always when we do luting, it's important to try to keep the operation field dry, to try to keep away saliva. Saliva is a terrible contaminant, which inhibits the adhesion massively. And the problem with saliva is, because of its polarity, it sticks very firmly to two substrates. So always be careful. So using rubber dam when possible, it's important. So, well, as I said before, remove the big things with a sickle scaler afterwards, for example, air abrasion with powder, or if you don't have anything similar, you just can use polishing pastes for prophylaxis. That would be also an alternative. Yeah. That would be like the first step of cleaning.
When you use pastes, do you have any recommendations what we shouldn't use or what we should use?
Some people say if you're using a polishing paste which contains fluoride, you probably are going to inhibit etching, but there's no evidence at all. So in my opinion, when using a polishing paste, it should be like in a lot of situations in dentistry, it should be a material which you know how to use it and which you feel comfortable with. That's the most important thing. And this will make a good result, my opinion.
When you look at your surface before sandblasting, for example, usually covered the surface with a dentine bonding agent, like the IDS protocol, or do you even try to cover it with composite flow? What's your go-to in these cases, even after prepping?
Well, most teeth in which I have to do a preparation, it's, for example, for an indirect restoration, require a buildup, for example, an adhesive buildup. And of course, when you do this buildup, you have to bond to dentin, for example. I think in most of the cases, it's sufficient sealing. The dentin bonding you use to make the adhesion of the buildup or to fill any parts of the cavity first. I think it's for the first enough. Of course, there's this immediate dentin sealing protocol, which in my opinion is a very interesting possibility. So you can do this extra if you want. But for usual, I think I have no actual evidence for it. But I think if you just do a buildup or a partial reconstruction of the two substrates and you do your bonding before, this would be for the first enough.
If you don't cover everything with, for example, a composite or a build-up, would you distinguish between, for example, the more caries affected dentine, does this have a different kind of adhesion? Would you treat it differently than the normal fresh cut dentine?
Well, for normal fresh cut dentine, I think as we have just dentine as bonding substrate for the first, I think universal adhesives are a good possibility for doing this sealing. You don't, when you are merely in dentine, I think it's okay just to use, for example, universal adhesive because you don't need to etch with phosphoric acid. I think if you don't, it has some pros. If you just go for the no etch protocol when you're merely in dentine, because you have this infiltration of the bonding, the demineralization is just as deep as the infiltration of your adhesive. And it's a good possibility to use universal adhesives when you're merely on dentine. I think this will work good on fresh cut dentine, and it will also work good on dentine which was close to a caries affected area, so probably it's a little bit more sclerotic than fresh cut dentine. So I think maybe if we do just a scientific study and we go for the micro stuff and look inside, maybe there we can find some differences. But I think in clinics we won't see any big differences if we use it on fresh cut or maybe on sclerotic dentine.
Are your students at the university also using universal adhesives, or are they being taught differently?
We are very classic, and we want to show the students that bonding to dentine and bonding to two substrates, it's not like a magic thing. You just put one drop of one solution on it and you will have adhesion. We use a very classic multi-bottle system still today. It's a three-bottle system, consisting of two primers, primer adhesive, and afterwards we use the bond. We know we've been using this protocol ever since. I mean, I started at university in the year 2009, and adhesive dentistry in Erlangen started like 1994, I think. And always they stick always to this multi-bottle system, which you can use as selective edge or as total edge. It's working fine, and it's very reliable. You can give it to anybody of the students, you can give it to somebody who's really good and somebody who's maybe not so good. And the result in adhesion will be the same. And we have like no postoperative sensitivities. So it's very reliable. And I think it's also important for the didactic effect that as a student, you learn that bonding to two substrates is something which takes a lot of chemistry, a little bit of time. That's also important. It's not like rub it on it and that's it. Maybe today, very modern universal adhesives are capable of that. But I think when you learn it, you have to learn it like, okay, step one, step two, step three, and then you will get a good bonding. And afterwards, if you're trained in doing this bonding, you will capable to use any other system, which is more simple than this multi-bottle system.
It's interesting that you said that the results don't differ a lot under the students. Do you think they would differ if we would just tell them this is also a three-step system, but it's all the same universal adhesive? Do you think it would also differ, the result?
I still don't know it. I mean, the new generation of universal adhesive, it seems to work very fine in clinics, and also the scientific results in vitro are very good. But, you know, when it comes to something so important as adhesion, you never change a running system. So we're slowly trying to introduce the students to universal adhesive. So we got just one exercise in the Phantom course. It's a course in Germany, which we do before starting with the clinical course. And then we got one cavity where we show them how to use a universal adhesive. I think it's important also to learn how to use a universal adhesive because there are little differences to the older systems. Yeah. It's like you have to blow it away until all the solvents are evaporated. That's important. It's a big difference if you're using like a multi-bottle system where the last step is using this unfilled resin, where you have only just to reach a homogeneous layer after blowing. So it's important also to train them on that, and we're slowly trying to show them also how to use a universal adhesive.
Interesting. I actually would have guessed that the result probably is also the same, because there might be less mistakes.
Yes, that's probable. But I'm very careful because Well, okay, let's first try it and afterwards we'll see the results. I agree with you. It's simple using a one-step universal adhesive. It's more easy. But you have, I think, this little things, for example, like to blow it away until all the solvents go away. That's like a point, I think, which is important. And yeah, let's see. It's something maybe we have to make a study on it, if there are already some of them.
For the didactic thoughts about it, it's completely okay. Students should learn the hard way. And I mean, at my university, the gold standard adhesive was a two-bottle system.
Yeah.
And I was using it very long, actually, before I switched. Actually, I switched because I had problems with pooling in really deep cavities.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to spend a lot of time to get rid of this pooling, to get a nice x-ray in the end, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. One kind of advantage is that I can mix just a dual activator quite easily inside some of these universal systems.
Yeah.
And maybe even have the best of both worlds.
That's right. There are new possibilities. There are also materials which are compatible with others. And then you get like the dark curing of the adhesive. You can also do the light curing of the adhesive directly. Before it's developing, that's the thing I really enjoy about new materials and new technologies to see it. We're moving forward. We're learning from things that are working, and we're moving forward to make it more reliable, make it more simple. Yeah, but this takes a lot. Takes a lot of research. Takes a lot of chemistry. We will see.
Let's come back to the looting part again.
Yeah.
Because basically it's all about looting. Mm-hmm. We kind of got off track, but which is fine. There are no rules in podcasting. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see a lot of universal cements as well coming to the market.
Yeah.
Dual cure self-etch cements. So which team are actually you right now? For example, when it comes to, for example, onlay or inlay looting, are you just team light cure or team dual cure, if you say? And how do you judge the kind of simplification which are coming up? Or should the dentist rather stay on the standard dual cure thing?
Polymerization is a big point. It also depends a little bit on the indications you have. For example, if you want to have something which has to do with a lot of aesthetics, with very thin ceramics, it's maybe better to go for the light cure path. Because you always have this fear or this risk of discoloration when you have like dark curing systems inside a luting resin. So for veneers, probably maybe going for a light cure or a pure light cure, a luting resin might be a viable thing. First of all, I think a dentist should always use the materials he feels comfortable with and he knows how to use them. That's the most important thing. And then we know from studies we did that dual curing luting materials and always trying to make it cure extra with light improves the conversion rate of resins, of luting resins, and increases the strength of the luting. So whenever possible, do a dual light curing. This depends on many factors, on the thickness of the restoration, on the translucency of the restoration. And if you can really go for a dual cure, just do it. Do it because we will have better results on the long term. When it comes to light curing, you need a good lamp, you need a good output, and you need time. That's the most important thing because good curing takes time that everything can react in the resin. So you won't cure it like in a half a second. Our results showed that you don't have a risk of over light curing a resin. Probably the only problem is the heat generation. Yeah. But going for 20 seconds, 40 seconds, it's okay. And whenever your lamp has low output, you just can try to go for a longer curing time.
Is the heat generation really a problem?
First, it feels not comfortable. If you don't have anesthesia and you have a vital tooth under it, you will feel the curing unit, and it's very uncomfortable. The way we do light curing actually with the lamps we have, I think heat is something we have to keep in mind, but we don't have to overestimate this problem at all. Yeah. Mainly, I think when we're doing indirect restorations, we are also dealing a lot with teeth which are not vital anymore, which have a root canal treatment. So this aspect would be not that important when we have non-vital teeth. So I try to light whenever possible. But you have other situations where your material is not that translucent, of course, then you have to rely on the dark cure system of the lutein resin. That's a big point. Chemistry inside there has to be very fine balanced to start and to make a good conversion. Yeah. So whenever possible, take both worlds, take light and take the other. So dual curing whenever possible.
I think we can sum up if it's like the anterior region, very thin, pure light curing is recommended. And if it's moving to the exterior, we more get in the dual curing area. Or would be, apart from zirconia crowns maybe in the anterior, would there be indication for you to use dual cure in the anterior?
If we, for example, have an anterior crown in the premolars or where we got more material thickness, I think it's okay to use a dual curing luting resin.
Are you a fan of the tech cure possibility, or do you move the excess cement somehow differently?
Tech cure technique, for example, when doing crown, it's good, it's fine. It's a possibility really to manage the excess and do the excess removal. It's a fine technique. I use it when doing crowns. For example, when looting glass ceramic crowns, I do a lot of tech cure. It's fine for cleaning, and also you don't have the oxygen inhibition layer. As you take off the excess, the resin gap is polymerized at a relative higher level, so you won't have that extent of oxygen inhibition layer as if you would do it the other way around.
What would be the other way around? Just to remove it with a brush?
Remove it carefully with a brush, and then, for example, to put an air block on side, like a glycerin gel, for example, to inhibit oxygen layer. Yeah. However, this would be more like the protocol, for example, for a conventional luting with conventional adhesive luting with a composite.
Is oxygen inhibition layer really clinically relevant, or is it more or less something academic?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, we know that if we look at the lab on it, we will see that the oxygen inhibition layer will not withstand abrasion or tooth brushing or dissolution the way like a full cured resin would do. So having that in mind, knowing that, we should try to avoid that. It's one of those things where I say, okay, we know it from the theory, then as we know it, just try to do it in clinics. We just had to look if there's any interesting studies on that point. Yeah.
Are there any alternatives to the glycerin gel to get rid of this oxygen inhibition layer?
Could polish it away, but this is not practicable if you're doing it, for example, on a crown or the margin of a inlay, for example. And you don't want to have the gap. You just want to have the perfect seal, to have a perfect, ideal, even resin gap between your two substrates and your restoration. So trying to avoid this gap by putting an air block on it would be the ideal.
But do you also use an air block on your direct composites?
I sometimes think about it. Well, so often you just do a little bit of adjustment and you go for the polishing anyway of the restoration. So at that point, you would remove also the oxygen inhibition layer. But yeah, there are some people who are doing that. They do the modulation and afterwards they put the air block on it and try to avoid that. I think it's a different setup when you have got an oxygen inhibition layer on the gap of a luting. And when you have like a thin oxygen inhibition layer on the top of a restoration, which will be polished anyway. When it comes to an indirect restoration, like the gap is like the place where erosion or maybe a decay of the restoration could start. So trying to keep this gap as sealed as possible would be like the goal of our treatment. And I think it's a different, little bit a different setup than on a big normal direct restoration where we have to polish it anyway or do a little bit more of occlusal adjustments.
It's okay. It was a tricky question anyway.
Yes.
No, but sometimes when we're talking, I kind of want to know if it's strict. I mean, if the answer is that we don't need it because it's easier to polish that area.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I think the most important thing is to know the principles you're dealing with. Once you know the principles, to say, okay, if I do that, then this could happen. And there's like a chemical or evidence, a clinical or a scientific evidence for it. Knowing that gives you freedom of choice to choose the path of your treatment and decide what, in your opinion, is the best way to go for you and for your patient. So that's the point, which I like to have knowledge. So knowledge gives us freedom and gives us the possibility to have really good, reliable treatment for our patients.
Now there are a lot of kind of universal looting cements hitting the market, which are self-edge. Some come with an extra primer. Where do you see the indications for the future, and where are the indications now?
This materials, the so-called self-adhesive cements or luting cements, I prefer to call them self-adhesive luting resins, because when we talk about a cement, a cement is a material which cures by an acid-base reaction. And the self-adhesive resin cements or luting resins, as I prefer to call them, they are resins. They cure by polymerization. So it would be more proper to call them, or I prefer to call them luting resins, self-adhesive luting resins. I think it's a very interesting material class, which we've been doing research. I've been doing research on them since 2012. It's so interesting that you don't need to have to pre-treat the two substrates and you can gain a good adhesion. So it was my opinion, like a first generation when the face came to the market, then these materials were further developed, like into this, like in my opinion, a second generation. And nowadays we're moving to this universal luting, self-adhesive luting resin, where you can combine these materials, the self-adhesive materials, with an extra primer. So in the case you want to have more adhesion, you can gain that by using a primer, a tooth primer, which is a simple tooth primer, and which is compatible to this luting, self-adhesive luting material. I think it's a good, for example, I use it a lot when I do glass ceramic crowns, for example. I prefer to lute them adhesively. And that when it's a crown, I always use these self-adhesive luting materials. For example, post and core restorations, when putting placing a post, it's also a good material to do that, because the adhesion we gain in the root channel, it's okay for a post, it's enough. The other question is, in many clinical cases, for example, you don't have enough retention when preparing a crown. Of course, when you look at the book or looking at pictures, we see these perfect cases where you have always like the perfect direction of your abutments after the preparation, the perfect conicity, the perfect retention. But not always in clinics we have this case that we have like enough macro retention for our crowns, for example, and that's another place where you use self-adhesive luting resins. Yeah, and if you have nowadays a little bit more of retention by using maybe a primer, then you can extend this. You have a good all-rounder material, for example, if you do a partial crown, for example. So this would be like a possible, or it's like something where you can use, you also maybe use them. Yeah, these are relative new materials, this universal self-adhesive luting resins. And this opens new possibilities. And we have to see how this develops. And this is the interesting thing. One step brings to the other, and the materials get like more refined, and you have more possible indications. And this gives you more freedom in your treatment to find just like the perfect indication, like the perfect material for this case you're dealing with them. Just get the best result for your patients.
Right now, what does the evidence say? Is this right now supporting it, or do we still need to wait for some good literature?
There's a plenty of in vitro studies on the self-adhesive resin cements, or not on this newest generation where the combination is with these primers, but for the others, there are studies showing which are the important material properties when it comes to luting. And there are also some clinical studies showing that they work fine, for example, when luting inlays, for example. Some studies from Regensburg and others from the Netherlands and others also from Erlangen, from a colleague of mine, they are still in service, these restorations, and they're fine. It's based on inlays.
So inlays and self-edge resin and luting resins. I try to, you know, in the office, everything is cementing. It's bonding. Yeah. You just
self-adhesive resin cements. It's go for the classical label for these materials. Yes, there are some studies dealing with the inlays, and they are clinically working.
Could there be any drawbacks where the dentist should be careful, don't use it in this indication or in this situation, or are the advantages of the, let's say, it's not as complex as cementation or the looting. So you should rather use these ones now.
First of all, always have a look at the instructions of use from the manufacturers. And there will you find exactly all the indications which the manufacturer gives for this material. When it comes to very thin restorations, for example, when you need a lot of adhesion for the classical self-adhesive resin cements, there the conventional looting would be rather indicated. For example, veneers should be classically adhesive. You should go for a classical conventional adhesive looting. But for example, for glass ceramic crowns, it's a good possibility. Also for zirconia restorations, like zirconia crowns, self-adhesive resin cements are very good because they also can have a very good adhesion to zirconia. That's very fine. And maybe for all the materials, we got a good retention, and you want to also have adhesion there, you can use self-adhesive resin cements. But always there where you need like a maximum of adhesion and you go for very thin restorations, then you should always think about maybe going for the conventional adhesive pathways. And now let's see how this changes with this new universal self-adhesive resin cements we have to see.
So the zirconia Maryland bridges are typical dual cure or self.
Well, Maryland, it depends a little bit. For example, if you get like restorations which are looting to enamel, mainly to enamel, then you have to go maybe for a classical pathway of adhesion with etching the enamel. But if you've got a lot of dentin surfaces, then self-adhesives will work fine.
I think we basically covered it.
Okay. Yeah, we can still talk a lot about pre-treatment of the different indirect restoration substrates, for example. That's also an interesting point. Yeah.
What's the point you find most interesting in the pre-treatment?
First of all, it's important to have clean surfaces. Sometimes I see that colleagues just say, okay, this my dental technician already pre-treated the surfaces. For example, zirconia, already did the abrasion. And when you do the try-in, this will get contaminated with saliva. So you have to clean the surfaces properly. I, for example, prefer to do the air abrasion of restorations by myself. So I have the control after doing the try-in. Then for glass ceramics, etching with hydrofluoric acid there afterwards it's clean, really. And if you don't have those possibilities, just do have to do special cleaners for that. But it's something always to keep in mind, clean substrates. On the tooth side and also on the restoration side.
Actually, I also etch everything personally.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. You know.
But the most interesting question, even when it comes to glass ceramic, what do you do after the etching?
Yeah.
Do you clean the etched surface?
There are some people claiming, well, that there are a lot of precipitates inside after the etching. Yeah, you can put it, for example, into an ultrasonic bath and cleaning it. That's a possibility. Others etch it again with phosphoric acid. Yeah, I think the most important thing after etching is also to do a proper rinsing, eliminate as far as possible any remnants. Of course, this won't have the same effect as if maybe doing an ultrasonication when we, for example, prepare specimens for the SEM after etching ceramics and we go for the SEM, we put them inside the ultrasonic bath. But I think clinically it works if you just go for the rinsing. But this is again a decision which everybody has to take by himself. I don't want to be dogmatic on that. Yeah. But I think the most important thing really is to etch or do the proper surface pre-treatment for each material, and then afterwards put the proper, in case of glass ceramics, go for a silane, for example. That's the important thing that maybe makes the difference, in my opinion.
The silane. How long do you let it on the glass ceramic? Just this typical 1 minute after instructions?
Yeah, I would suggest really to follow the instructions because this process of salinization of the surfaces goes by means of a condensation reaction. The solvents, and when this reaction takes place between the silane and the glass ceramic surface, the results in this chemical reaction there is a condensation reaction. There develops water or an alcohol, and this has to evaporate. So you have to give them time really to that this reaction can take place. And then you will get like a very good monolayer of silane with a good cross-linking. So on the chair side, it's like most of the materials suggest is 60 seconds. Look at silanes for dental technicians. They just go for longer times, like 5 minutes. And there are interesting studies where they like leave the silane like 60 minutes in an oven, and then they get like amazing results of adhesion. But well, this is clinically not practicable. Yeah. Imagine.
60 minutes in an oven. I never heard of it.
Yeah, I have to look for the exact literature, but there are some people doing it like for 60 minutes. This is like experimental.
Okay, Di Jose, I have one last question, which I actually always wanted to know, because I've always been protecting the silanized area from light. Do I really need to do that?
Well, if it's just only the silanized surface, yeah, and yes, there's no resin on it or anything, in most cases you don't need to protect that from light, because it's just the silanized ceramic surface. There won't take any polymerization reaction there for most of the materials we use. I think you don't need to do that.
So as long as I use kind of up-to-date multi primer, it's okay.
Yeah.
Or are there any salinization agents from the past which are light sensitive? Where does this myth come from?
Well, maybe we're too young. I don't know. There are some methac-related silane preparations, but nowadays they are not used in general. So maybe it's just the best place to keep your inlay. Maybe it comes from the time where you etched your glass ceramic, then you place the silane in it, and then they used to put unfilled resin on the surface, probably from that time. Then after putting this unfilled resin on the silanase surface, you had to protect them from light because this was light curing. Probably it comes from this, but just a mere silanase ceramic surface with those normal products we use nowadays don't have to be protected from light.
Maybe it's just a good place, but it's the inlay only, yeah. It's not getting lost.
It's a safe place, so it won't fall down or something like that. Yeah, those the mysteries of dentistry. Yeah. Why do we do that?
It's a myth buster for the end.
Yeah, that would be a great podcast, so myth busting dentistry.
Well, there are so many myths, it will be hard to even talk about them.
Yeah.
But different podcast.
Different podcast.
Okay. Thank you, dear Jose.
Thank you so much
for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
What will be the topic of your lecture?
The lecture will be entitled From Self-Adhesive to Universal Luting, What is Changing? So we will talk in detail about different topics we just touched today. We'll talk in general about when we need to have adhesive luting, which are the principles behind this conventional adhesive luting procedure. And then we'll talk about self-adhesive luting or self-adhesive cementation, which are the principles behind, how does it clinically work, and then we will see what is changing. So we will have a look on this universal self-adhesive universal luting material, how it works, which are the principles behind, and also I will show two different clinical cases, one regarding cementation or luting, adhesive luting of a glass ceramic restoration, and then of a zirconia restoration. So we will have an overlook into detail of all this adhesion protocols, from self-adhesive to the universal luting, what is changing.
Great. Looking forward for your pictures. You always take very nice pictures.
I try to do my best. I try to keep it real, you know. I just, these are pictures I make from that when I do it clinically. It's just real. There's a real pictures. It's not like I have the patient the whole day there and I place a rubber dam 10 times afterwards, and this is like the normal procedure I do. And yeah, thank you very much
for the talk.
Okay, thank you.
See you soon.
Okay, see you. Thank you. Bye bye.